The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. This week, we look at the science of food and the chemistry behind cocktails. Author Howard McGee reveals how he made academic food science palatable to home cooks, the importance of heat as an ingredient, and why he likes hanging out with Heston. And I visit the Drink Factory research labs to find out how to make the perfect martini, why mixology has taken off, and whether a martini really tastes different if it's shaken rather than stirred. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Howard McGee is a culinary scientist and one of the most celebrated cookery writers in the US. Published 30 years ago, his book On Food and Cooking became a classic, and the follow-up, Keys to Good Cooking, is a primer on kitchen chemistry based on the premise that if you know why something happens, you might have more control over it. Having started out at Caltech wanting to be an astronomer, McGee moved into literature before having a revelation, as he told The Guardian's Pascal Wise.
I looked around and realized that there was this aspect of everyday life that clearly had to do with chemistry, and yet no one had really written about it. And when I discovered that there was a huge literature in food science and technology that had never been translated for the home cook, the restaurant cook, and people who just love food, I thought, okay, now I've got a project. And the first book was the result of that.
Tell us a little bit more about that literature that you discovered. What style was it in, and was it fiercely technical and scientific?
Exactly. It was in obscure journals like the Journal of the Science of Food and Agriculture and Poultry Science and things like this. And I cracked them open and saw, you know, micrographs of wheat flakes, breakfast cereal. And it was really cool to see something that I ate every day for breakfast close up like that, and seeing the technical challenges of keeping it crisp for a reasonable amount of time after you add the milk. Same with the structure of the egg. I mean, just all these aspects of food that I just never thought about. And it really did give me the feeling this is stuff the world needs to know. And, sure. And that's why I wrote the book.
It's interesting when you fuse the words science and food. The respective parties, to a degree, seem to run back into their stereotypes. The food people, you know, talk about this sort of handed-on tradition and something very kind of rural and romantic. Yeah. And then, you know, there's a feeling that on the science side, it's full of horrors and Frankenstein food and all the rest of it. Have you felt a change in that relationship between those two words over your years of writing on this?
Yeah, in fact, it's been amazing to see that transition, many transitions in the world of food, but that's certainly one of them, because science doesn't create Frankenfoods. It creates information, which then people in cereal companies can turn into Frankenfoods if they so choose. But that same knowledge helps the average cook understand what they're doing and do it better. And so I think people understand now that the knowledge itself is neutral and valuable, and the Frankensteinians are doing their thing, but we're doing something. Even people who are cooking as traditionally as possible value the fact that they know why traditional techniques work the way they do, and that's worth a lot.
Yeah, you touch on that idea of traditional techniques, and I'm interested to know how this journey of you know, creating recipes and tasting them, and perhaps often just coming across techniques by accident, how well in your research you feel that's done? I mean, has it actually, are there some real surprises where the recipes and the traditions really are at odds with the science? How well have they married together?
Well, I wouldn't say that they're at odds with the science, but maybe the science has just ignored them. And the scientist's initial response would be, oh, that doesn't sound like a good idea, or I don't think that's going to work. But in fact, one of the very first experiences I had writing the book convinced me of the fact that cooks know a lot of things that maybe scientists don't. And that had to do with this traditional French technique of making egg foams, meringues and soufflés in a copper bowl. And I read that and read the kind of semi-chemical explanations that cooks would give for it, and I knew that the explanations had to be wrong, and therefore the technique had to be bunk. And so I just kind of wrote it off until I saw the evidence that this tradition went back centuries. And so I thought, well, if it's lasted that long, maybe there's some substance to it. So I did what I should have done in the first place. I bought a copper bowl, and I did an experiment side by side, copper bowl, glass bowl, eggs beaten right next to each other. And huge difference in the way they looked, the way they behaved in cooking and so on. And I asked egg chemists, there are such things as egg chemists, what was going on, and they said, oh, that's very unlikely. Are you sure that really happened? But I saw it with my own eyes. And so I realized that there were a lot of things that are true that scientists have never looked closely enough at to verify and understand. These things deserve to be known as much as possible so that this kind of savoir-faire doesn't get written off as old cook's tales. You know, there's usually, if it's a tradition that lasts, there's a reason for that, and it's probably because it works.
yeah, exactly. And I there are wonderful stories that take, you know, part in your columns and in the books of you properly testing all these things. I love the fact that you've really, you know, gone to town and to see how much olive oil or oil, you know, an egg can take. Give us some of your favorite debunking stories, if you like. I mean, I'll give you my favorite is the, you know, the searing of meat holding in juices and all the rest of it. You know, that's clearly a myth, but I'd love to hear some of your favorite debunked cookery things.
Well, you know, that searing meat, sealing in the juices, that turns out to be an old chemist's tale. It was actually a chemist who came up with that idea that searing the outside somehow cauterizes it and prevents fluids from passing back and forth. In fact, when he wrote in the middle of the 19th century, the standard culinary way of dealing with meat was exactly the opposite. It was to start it off very slowly, low temperature, and then brown it at the very end, just before you serve it. He came along with this cockamamie idea and changed things for the worse, and he was a chemist. So that's also very worth remembering. But when it comes to debunking things, I mean, I don't feel that that's exactly what I'm doing. I feel what I'm doing is testing the received wisdom to see whether there's another way of doing it that might be just as good. So
that's a much more diplomatic and sensitive way of putting it, and thank you for correcting that.
One of my favorites there is the idea that to cook pasta properly, you have to cook it in gallons of boiling water to prevent the noodles from sticking to each other, which is in every Italian cookbook I've ever seen. And that's the way I always did it for years and years, until one day I was pouring down the drain a couple of gallons of hot salted water that had taken half an hour to come up to the boil, and then I cooked for 5 minutes, and then I was throwing it out again. It seemed to me this is a big waste of water, energy. Can I do it any other way? And so I ended up seeing if I could cook pasta more like a risotto. So you put the pasta in the pan with as little water as possible, and then add a little more if you need to, but basically minimize the amount of water you're using. And not only do the noodles not stick to each other, because you start with cold water, and that kind of lubricates the noodles so that they don't stick. It's the heat that really gets them sticky. But what you end up with is not noodles that stick to each other and are kind of gloppy. You end up with noodles properly cooked and then this wonderful thick sauce, because they've exuded this starch as they've cooked. And so and all you have to do is add a little olive oil, stir it around, you have this emulsion that is just a beautiful, simple sauce. So I wrote that thinking revolutionary and immediately got letters from people saying, oh, of course, that's the way they cook pasta in Liguria. You know, so there were outposts of that way of doing things that have just never made it into the mainstream Italian cookbooks. I wasn't discovering anything. I was just kind of rediscovering what cooks have known for a long time.
Yeah, that's interesting that, you know, recipes are, they're sort of templates, aren't they? And we hold on to recipes for lots of different reasons. You know, there's nostalgia attached to them, perhaps they're handed down, or there's, you know, and we get attached to particular flavours. The other thing that we use all the time in the kitchen, which we don't seem to understand very well often as cooks, is heat.
Yeah, and heat is really difficult to get a handle on, because I think of it as an ingredient like anything else in the kitchen. But the problem with heat as an ingredient is that it's invisible and intangible. I mean, you can feel high heat, but that really doesn't tell you anything more than it's hot. Finding ways to measure it, finding ways to get a feeling for how it flows in the kitchen, I think is a big part of becoming a well-practiced cook, is just realizing how it is that this invisible ingredient behaves.
It's really nice to think of it as an ingredient in that way. I know that you're going on to look more into the world of taste. That's really interesting in terms of science, because it seems to me that you're approaching something yet more subjective. How are you applying the science to your new thinking, specifically in areas of taste?
Well, I've ended up taking an approach that moves away from the subjective and as much as possible toward the objective, simply because the biology, the neurobiology of taste and smell is absolutely fascinating and intricate. And what it boils down to practically is we're all smelling and tasting different things. Even when we sit down and eat exactly the same dish, that means to me that what I would be interested in then is not so much why you smell or taste differently than I do. It's more, regardless of who's eating or smelling, what's out there to be smelled? What is the world of possibilities that are there to be enjoyed? So that's what I'm writing about, is the molecules in the world that give us pleasure or that disgust us, and what are they doing there? Why are they there?
And I suppose our senses are interconnected. There's a certain synesthesia that goes on in taste, isn't it? I mean, what we're looking at and what we're hearing can affect taste. Is that right?
Yes, very much so. And Charles Spence at Oxford has done a lot of work to demonstrate that in many, many different ways. And things that you wouldn't necessarily think would have any bearing on the way things taste. But it's true that the whole context of the act of eating affects the way you perceive what it is that you eat. And it kind of makes sense when you step back from it and think about it. Back when we were in our early evolutionary days, we weren't sitting down to tables and kind of savoring things and chatting about the nuances. We were trying to decide very quickly, is this good for me or not good for me? And did I just hear something coming around the corner or not? Even though we don't think about it, all our senses are very highly attuned to what's happening as we eat, and they have an effect on our experience.
You've worked with great chefs, including Heston Blumenthal. I'm interested to know what it is Heston is seeking from you when you two get together in a kitchen. Is he after the data to support what he's discovering? How does it work?
Well, actually, Heston is one of the most curious and learned people I know. He hides the learnedness very well. I mean, you can tell that he's fascinated by everything and enthusiastic, but the knowledge that he has, just voracious reading in the technical literature and elsewhere, is a big part of his success, I think. And so when we get together, it's usually not to ask me for any particular piece of information. It's to bounce his ideas off of me and see what I think and see if I happen to have another piece of the puzzle that he might not. So it's really much more that. It's kind of talking things through.
If you don't mind, I'm going to ask you to slightly jump through the hoops here. I've got a few quick fire questions, which I know will be very difficult to cram a fully scientific answer into. But here we go. Your technique for a perfect soft-boiled egg.
For soft-boiled egg, I think the traditional way, so cooking in boiling water for a few minutes, depending on how well done you like it.
Should I put vinegar in the pan when I poach an egg?
No, doesn't do a thing except make it taste like vinegar.
Okay. Is there any truth in the five-second rule?
No, 5 seconds. Once something hits the floor, within milliseconds, it's got bugs on it.
Would you brine a chicken, or is the osmosis theory not really relevant?
Brining a chicken is a good idea if what you want is a juicy chicken, but brining a chicken means that the chicken is going to be salty and taste more like what we would call delicatessen chicken than roast chicken.
Okay, how would you kill a lobster?
I'm allergic to crustaceans. I've never dealt with that.
Good answer. Knead the dough when making bread or not?
It depends on how quickly you want it. If you're willing to wait a few days, then you don't have to touch it. But if you'd like it the next day or that day, then yeah, kneading is a good idea.
When, if ever, is a microwave the best cooking device?
I don't know that it's necessarily ever the best cooking device, but it's very useful for all kinds of things.
What device would you encourage everyone to have in their kitchen?
Device I would recommend is a point-and-shoot thermometer, an infrared thermometer.
Oh, I'm so glad to say I've got one of those. Harold, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you, and thank you for rescuing much of my cookery over the years. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Harold McGee in conversation with Pascal Wise there. And staying with the science of food and drink, last week I visited the Drink Factory Research Labs in London, where Tony Conigliaro and his team are looking to expand their techniques and push the boundaries of cocktail creation. Set up in 2005, the Drink Factory focuses on flavour and aroma in liquid form, and their inventive fruits of their labours have been taking London bars and restaurants by storm. I met up with Zoe Burgess, head of the research labs, and Professor Andrea Seller of University College London. I asked Zoe why mixology has taken off recently.
Well, I think as people have got more interested in food and flavours and eating and experiencing different things and have become more aware of flavours from all over the world, it's sort of fed down into the drinks. And what we're seeing now is people are really interested in their drinks. They understand that a lot of craftsmanship and thought goes into a drink. It's not just, you know, something that's slapdashed together. And people are really exploring flavours and flavour combinations and the science behind how you can really get the perfect serve. It's a great time for drinks.
And Andrea, you've been doing an awful lot of public communication of science, and this is something that you've taken out to people and shown them what's going on in their drink. What kind of response do you get? Are people sort of excited about that side of things?
Well, I think the wonderful thing about talking about cocktails or about food is that it's a phenomenal vehicle to be able to talk about very, very basic science that we see all around in the world. And because somebody is holding a drink in front of them, they can actually peer into their glass and often see some of the effects that are involved. And when I say that it's very basic, I'm not saying that it's easy, right? Some of this stuff is very profound and very complex. And yet, you've got this wonderful way of illustrating it. It's a tremendous opportunity that I think none of us, you know, those of us interested in popularizing science, but also those of us interested in teaching science, it provides a wonderful way of kind of hooking people. In the end, I don't think any of us can teach anything. The only thing is we can get people curious, and then they will teach themselves.
That's a really interesting point there about getting people sort of excited and into the idea of science. Are there myths that people come to these things with, you know, this notion of bruising gin and that sort of idea? Are there myths and misconceptions that you come across quite frequently?
Well, I think one of the myths and misconceptions, for example, is that if you distill alcohol, you can get it completely pure. And it turns out that's not true. You can get to around 95% pure, but at that point, you actually end up with a very, very interesting situation. It's called an azeotrope. And the azeotrope is a material where what distills out and what you have in the liquid are exactly the same. And so there's actually a limit to how far you can go in terms of the purity of your alcohol. And so I don't know whether you necessarily need the extra 5% from a cocktail point of view, but it's still kind of surprising.
And Zoe, from the point of view of someone who is working on developing new cocktails and coming up with new recipes, how have you found that science has inspired what you're doing here in the Drinks Factory Labs?
we look at things in great detail, and we like to get down into the nitty-gritty of ingredients and flavours. We're lucky enough to have a couple of rotary evaporator stills, which we use to make our own flavoured vodkas, redistill vodkas with different ingredients, and make reductions. So to understand what's going on in terms of the science and how we can use that to get better, cleaner flavours, or flavours which are more of a representation of what we're looking for, really helps.
Well, I think we should get on with making some cocktails, actually. I think that would be great. So perhaps we should start off. We're going to start with a martini.
Yes.
Is that right? Perhaps you can tell me, Zoe, what are the main ingredients here that we're going to be using?
Okay, so we've got gin, we've got dry vermouth, and we're going to garnish the martini with a lemon twist. So it's one of the seemingly most simple cocktails, but it's very easily made wrong if you don't get the dilution right.
And Andrea, can you tell me, is there any difference between different kinds of gin? Is there anything different happening with the chemistry of gin?
Well, there are huge differences. And it turns out that if you actually look at the gin overall, it's not a huge amount of difference in that, you know, you're 40% alcohol, the rest is pretty well all water. And yet it's the trace impurities which are crucial. And these are often referred to as the botanicals. They're small organic molecules which actually provide the flavor. And really, that's where the big difference lies. It's the process by which you kind of generate those flavors, which makes all the difference. One of the wonderful things is this resurgence that there's been really in the last 10, 15 years of small-scale artisanal producers who are doing it in, you know, little sort of warehouses and so on around London, and who are making these very, very interesting things that have a lot of different slants on what is essentially the same thing.
And are there particular molecules, particular kinds of compounds that you have in gin, a particular class that you normally come across in gin?
Well, gin is ultimately based on juniper and flavored with juniper. But most of the kind of volatile flavoring molecules, and when I say volatile, what I mean are things that evaporate quite easily. And therefore, they're the things that, when they reach your mouth, are going to evaporate and therefore interact with things in the receptors in your nose. Those kinds of molecules, to a chemist, are called terpenes. And terpenes are molecules which have carbons in multiples of 5. And they all come out of essentially the same metabolic pathway, one which actually leads ultimately to things like cholesterol, the steroids, all of those hormones. And those 5 carbon molecules, really, when you sort of disconnect them and reconnect them, and you add a little bit here and you change a little bit there, you just get this extraordinary kaleidoscope of things which smell everything from menthol across to things like almonds to juniper to pine and so on. And so really, that's where the secret lies in making a unique gin.
And so back to the martini. So what's the first thing you do when you make a martini, a good martini, Zoe? Give us the lowdown.
So I filled my cocktail tin with some really high quality ice, and I fill it to top with ice. We're going to add 50 ml of gin and then 15 ml of dry vermouth. And we're going to stir that down. And stirring is important here.
And why is stirring important?
Well, stirring is very important because what you want is an extremely uniform drink. But the other thing is that the two ingredients you've mixed together are actually at room temperature. And so by stirring them, or in some cases shaking them, you take the temperature down really nice and quickly.
And of course, we all know that James Bond was keener on the shaken rather than the stirred. Was he right? Was he wrong?
Well, it's an interesting question, and a lot of people thought for a long time that this was nonsense. But as a kind of joke, a professor at a medical school in the U.S. actually decided to get his students to do a kind of randomized control trial where they actually looked for the difference to see whether you could taste the difference. And apparently, one can taste the difference between the two, and no one's quite sure of why that might be.
So Zoe, what's the next thing that we do?
50 ml of gin we've just put into our cocktail tin. And now we've got 15 ml of dry vermouth. And then I'm just going to add a lemon twist to our martini.
Look at that, perfect drink right there. It's fantastic.
Now, many years ago when I was an undergraduate, I was invited by an elderly professor. He said, "Would you be my bartender tonight at this party?" And I went, "I've never made a cocktail in my life." And he said, "Look, just come along, it'll be fine." And somebody came up and said, I'd like a dry martini, please. And I thought, I have no idea how to make a martini. So I made a 2-to-1 mix of gin to vermouth and then handed it to the guy. He hadn't been watching what I was doing. He wandered off, came back about 30 seconds later going, what is this? Jesus, there's so much vermouth in it. And I said, well, yeah. And he said, no, this is how you do it. He filled the glass with gin. He then took the bottle of vermouth and he said, now you've got to do this clockwise. He swung the bottle 3 times round the glass in a clockwise direction, put it down again, picked up his glass and walked away.
Well, there we have it.
It was a dry martini.
It's a chemist's guide to cocktail making. You heard it here first. Zoe, Andrea, thank you very much.
That was Zoe Burgess and Andrea Seller serving me the perfect martini. And you can find out more at thedrinkfactory.com or read the article in full in this Sunday's Observer Tech Monthly. That's all for this week. Ian Sample will return from holiday next week. You can catch up on all the week's science stories at theguardian.com/science. But from me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.